Hey, my name's Jim Higgins. I'm an alcoholic. This is way early for me to be telling my story. I'm not used to early morning meetings. But, you know, when I was first getting sober, I went to pretty much then it was a 10 o'clock meeting. It was about the earliest I was getting to, but it was a good way to start my day was with the meeting. I'm up here just to share my experience, strength, and hope. That's what they tell me I'm supposed to do, and that's all I can do. And it's my story. I can't tell people how they should do it or anything like that. I can just share what I did and, you know, what the people did for me that allowed me to be sober. And I'm a very grateful alcoholic. To still be alive is miraculous. you hear lots of stories around the rooms, and you know I believe, and it used to be a big thing in AA a long time ago where they'd have this thing that says there but for the grace of God, and that, you know, that's what it is through the grace of God. You know, I was given the opportunity to get sober, and I was given it a number of times. I didn't always take it. You know, I didn't take it the way it was given, and being still alive after all that is, and having a good life is just, like I said, it's miraculous. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, on November 1st, 1946. So you don't have to figure out how old I am. Just there you go. And the day I was born, my mother made my father come into AA. So, yeah, if he wanted to come home. So, you know, I'd been around AA as a kid, so I kind of knew what AA was. And you would think that that would have made a difference in my life, but it really didn't. I had to go out and do what I had to do. When I finally started getting old enough that, people were suggesting that alcohol might be a problem or I might be an alcoholic, I would say, well, no, I'm not, I'm not a bad alcoholic, or, all of those things, I was in total denial. I could even say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, but I don't need these meetings because I haven't got to the point where I have to have them. And anyways, the very, very first AA meeting I went to, I was 6 years old, it was kind of a weird thing. So I knew what this was about. But when I was 14, I picked up my very, very first drink. And I hear some people talk about how they crossed over the line after years of drinking. Well, I crossed over the line when I was 14 years old. With my first drink, I drank for effect. And I loved it, and every opportunity I had to drink after that is what I did. And it was always for effect. I didn't, the concept of so-called social drinking just never entered my mind. You know, it was just, hey, let's party down. And, I did that, for years. And I was able to, live a fairly productive life doing that. Early on, I don't like spending a whole lot of time on the drunkalogue, but when I was a kid, we moved, we moved a lot, because even though I said my dad had come in AA, periodically he would go out and try this stuff again, and just about every time that happened, we would end up moving. So I ended up going. I don't think I was in any one school for longer than 3 years, and that was just the pattern. So I was always the new kid on the block, couldn't relate with anyone. And I was kind of a chameleon. I would fit in with all these different groups. I was, wherever I happened to be, I could relate with that. But even though I fit in with the groups, I still felt, totally alone. I was pretty much a loner for long periods of time. looking back on that now, I've only got, you know, I hear a lot of people say, oh yeah, you know, my friends from school and stuff. I have one friend from school, been my friend since high school, and just one. He's an alcoholic too, by the way, and you know, that may have something to do with it. I don't know, but you know, my school in my early days, you know, they kind of progressed. I was kind of weird because I was halfway geek. I was into things like ham radio and stuff. I love that. But I was also way out there in La La Land in other ways. I burglarized a house when I was 14 years old. You know, prior to that, my dad had these plans that I was going to end up going to West Point and doing all that stuff. It kind of blew a hole in that. But, you know, anyways, I lived these kind of multiple lives, you know. I'd be kind of straight in this one area, yet crazy in the others. And, you know, just on a daily basis. And that part of my life, you know, it progressed like that for a long, long period of time. As I'd hold down these really straight jobs, you know. And but at night, you know, I turned into this monster, you know, this completely different person. And it was just a crazy life, you know. It was just absolutely nuts. I look back on that, and I can't quite figure it out. And you know, nowadays I come to lots and lots of meetings, and at first I came to lots and lots of meetings because I had to. I do it now because I want to. You know, I really, you know, this program means so much to me. The steps that gave me a life, because it was nuts back there, and I have to look on how exactly it was. And I went through this progression where I was doing, you know, pretty well in, you know, in business and stuff. I was had this great job, you know. Things just kind of kept getting better. I managed to buy this new GTO, and then I drank a fifth of liquor and totaled that and almost died. And that's when I was like 20 years old. And you know, that was so weird, because when I finally came to in the hospital, all I could taste was the liquor that I'd had before. And when I got out of the hospital, I went to my usual bar, and I had a beer, and this friend of mine handed me a shot. And the way my body reacted, I smelled the shot and I threw up. And don't do that when your jaw's wired shut. That's real bad. But, you know, over a period of months, I was able to overcome that, you know? Because, you know, you can work your way back. When your body's saying, okay, this stuff's going to kill you, you know, the way you work your way up is you start back with mixed drinks and things like that. And pretty soon you can get back to drinking shots again. And that's what I did. You know, and, you know, I did a little bit of control then, you know, because I didn't total another car for a while. It was quite a while anyways. And, you know, I said, you know, my life needs something. And ultimately what I did is I married my first wife, who, you know, to this day, I still feel badly about that, because she was a victim. She had no idea what kind of alcoholic I was. I had no idea what kind of alcoholic I was. You know, that thing with the car wreck was just, you know, that was kind of an inconvenience thing. I won't do that again, and you know, I won't try to control that. So meanwhile, my career is moving on and I'm getting a good job. We moved to Vermont and I'm up at IBM and everything's rocking on. But you know, part of the thing was I wasn't happy with life, so you know, we had a kid to solve that, and got a new house. And you know, when the kid wasn't making me happy, you know, we needed another kid, you know, to keep the first one company and to make us happy, make her. You know, it was always something. You know, I needed a new and better car, and You know, it was just one thing after another. But, you know, at that point, you know, I was in electronics and all that stuff up at IBM and everything straight. And I would wear like a three-piece suit to work and all that stuff and, you know, just get drunk every night, and that was it. Around that period, and this was like the late 60s, I decided, well, I kind of migrated into being a hippie. And I no longer wore three-piece suits, you know, I'd wear hippie stuff. I don't know how you'd tell it. But anyways, you know, that's where I went. And I started, you know, smoking pot and doing various things. And around this time, I, you know, was starting to move into, you know, minor drugs and things. And I, on one of my late night trips to a bar, I was driving home and totaled yet another car into this other car. And anyways, we lived in this very small town in Vermont, and the policeman that you know, came, you know, was to the accident scene, he was on his way home, and he was my neighbor, and he was also an alcoholic. So he took me to the town doctor because I could see my kneecap and things. And the town doctor gave me this big envelope of codeine sulfate, you know, because it was a town doctor. This is the, nobody knew anything about drug things up there. And I loved those things, you know. But anyways, I did, you know, things were progressing. I was, you know, finding a girlfriend and things like that. And this one day I went to work at IBM, and you know, I took a whole bunch of these pills, and I OD'd. I was hallucinating, and I tried to cut myself up, and they hauled me off to the local booby hatch, you know, the psych hospital. It was a regular hospital with a psych ward. I don't know why they did that. But, you know, this was, to them, very strange. It was, they had their own company doctor, and I'm listening, he's never seen anything like this, you know, because this was way back then, and it was a big plant, like 4,000 people. And so anyways, I'm up there for a while, and, you know, I'm still thinking, you know, my problem is, you know, society, because, hey, I'm a hippie, and you know, it's the world that's the problem. So this girlfriend I had met, she helped me escape. And we hitchhiked from, you know, there in Vermont, from Burlington, Vermont. And we were headed towards Haight-Ashbury, me and her and a dog named Boo. We were, honest to God. You know, I was a real cliche. I got as far as Denver, Colorado, and ended up in another psych ward. So, you know, that was kind of the end of that excursion. Ended up back in Vermont at that psych ward. When I got out, I still had my job at IBM. All this time I was gone hitchhiking cross country, they're still sending checks to my wife. So, you know, I was treated well. After, you know, maybe a few months, I figured that my real problem was this place where I was working and stuff, and I just needed to get back to Cleveland, Ohio. Now, right there, that tells you something about my insanity. You know, wanting to move back to Cleveland, Ohio was, you know, a strange thing. So, I knew you'd like that bit. But, you know, that's where I ended up back. And I ended up running into some people, you know, from school, and, you know, I was still doing the bars and stuff, but I was kind of migrating from the peace, love, hippie thing to, you know, amongst other things, I was a dope dealer and, you know, hooking up with some really crazy, crazy people. And, you know, that's kind of the way it rolled. But, you know, I'd get, from time to time, I'd get these nice straight jobs where I'd go to work and be straight and then come out at night and party with these people that were just, you know, absolutely insane, or, you know, criminal, you know, some people would say. But, you know, and that's the way it went for a while. And, you know, my first wife, she was putting up with this, and you know, bless her heart, she didn't deserve that at all. And I found another girlfriend. I found a girlfriend in a bar, and I figured that was my problem. Was, you know, my first wife, she didn't drink, or you know, she was a really nice person. So, but the second one, she, you know, she met my needs in a sense that she could drive better than I could when she was drunk, and you know, take care of me when I was drunk, and she drank with me, and you know, this was a, you know, to me that was an important part of my new relationship. So, you know, I ended up with her, and we ended up, you know, moving here. Meanwhile, you know, like I say, I had two kids with my previous wife, and you know, my company moved me down to Georgia about that time, and she came down here with me, and then we started developing the second family with my next two kids. But we were, you know, we were just, you know, partying all the time, and you know, drinking and doing stuff, and you know, just trying to get by. But you know, I had then divorced my first wife, so you know, it's, I was making my child payments and taking care of things, you know, when we discovered that she was pregnant and I got married to her. And the thing is, back then, on my son's first birthday, this is my third child, my son, on his third, on his first birthday, me and my wife were partying, or whatever you want to call it, and there was some sort of disagreement, I guess, because there was furniture flying out the windows of the apartment and stuff, and they called the DeKalb County Police. And when the police got there, they arrested both of us for, you know, well, the felony drug possession and stuff like that. So they took our son, and you know, with defects, and put him there overnight. And for some strange reason, I had always considered myself a good parent. Now I don't know why, where I got that thought that I was, but you know, when we got out of jail, I knew that I was going to have to get straight and go down and talk to these people. And I also knew that I couldn't. You know, I'd been doing lots of drugs. They found lots of stuff in the house, and you know, syringes and all kinds of goodies. And you know, it was just crazy. It's so that brought me to my first time of AA down here in Georgia, because I knew that I couldn't go that week without doing that. When I tell my story, I get confused on the time and stuff, because every time I tell it, it's different. I don't write anything down. I mean, it's all stuff that happened, but there's different things. Because I left out that when I was up in Cleveland back in 1974, I tried to come into AA on the marijuana maintenance plan. And, you know, I had a pound of pot, and I came in, and I said, I will no longer shoot heroin, and, you know, or drink hard liquor, and I'll just smoke pot. And, you know, that worked for 9 months, okay? Which probably saved my life, because back then, you know, things were going very poorly. Sometime around the end of that, this gets very confusing for me. But around the end of the time, anyways, I ended up doing a year in jail up there because I was shooting up barbiturates all day long, and we went. Anyways, I ran into 7 cars in a parking lot with a cop watching. Right, this is right after I broke my ankle, and the cop, we're in a high speed chase at 5 miles an hour, and I open the car door and throw out the drugs so I don't get caught, and lands on a cop's foot. So, you know, it was. But anyways, you know, that cost me a year, you know. And that was, in the meantime, you know, and then I moved to Fort Lauderdale, yada, yada, yada. You know, it's all a continuing story of just from one insane situation to another. But, you know, this, you know, let me jump back to coming to Georgia for the first time, because that's where my real sobriety started, was here. And I didn't get this the first time here when I tried to do it. Obviously, I didn't get it in 74. I wasn't even coming close to it. But when I came here, you know, it's I kind of got involved in the program, and I had 2-3 year stretches of sobriety. And the first time was, like I said, I came in when they took away our son, and I said, "Oh, this is a good idea." And my wife came in too. This is my second wife. It's hard to keep track sometimes. But, yeah, she came in, and you know, so there for a while, we're living a reasonable life. Now, I didn't do these steps the way they were suggested. You know, I did my version of them. And, you know, I got a resentment at my wife after about 3 years for something that was going on. And, you know, I went out at 8 o'clock in the morning, started drinking. And by noon, I had almost got shot by a cop, got in a high-speed chase, and locked up in Pickens County. They were really impressed with the Easy Does It bumper sticker on my car. You know? But the... As soon as I got out of jail, I came back to meetings, and then I was sober for another 3 years. In the meantime, we moved up to Michigan. I had to get a job where they had insurance. My son was chronically ill, and we had to get some insurance. So this place, you know, they had decent insurance. So I went up there, and, you know, after about another 3 years, what happened is we both ended up going out, and you know, started using various things, and she brought home her new fiance from Denver, and that was when I decided I better get sober. I need to do something. I need to get out of Michigan before I kill somebody or somebody kills me. Or, anyways, so I left Michigan and came back to the Howe place. Now, these first passes of 3 years that I was telling you about, they were at Howe Place, at the original Howe Place is where that was. I started going to Howe Place. I had about maybe a year sober when the Howe Place, the old one, opened for the first time. And, you know, so I came back down here because this is where I did have some decent sobriety, even though I wasn't doing the steps in the way it was. I came down here, and I was pitiful. I was, I had reached the end of it. I sat in a parking lot of Bells Ferry and Highway 92. This was July 10th, 1988. And I had a can of gasoline, and I was either going to pour it on myself and light it or get sober. So I decided to go down the street, and, fellow Warren, and I went to his house, and I ended up living in Warren's basement for like 6 weeks. And this was a period of time when he was sober. And, you know, he's sober today, thank God. He didn't get it the first time either. But, you know, he was there for me, and what happened was I started doing things way differently this time. It was just... I started, you know, we read this all the time. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our path. I have never seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed a path. My first passes at the program, some of the things I never did is I never wanted to get in touch with this higher power. You know, that was an abstraction. And I've heard someone say around the rooms that, you know, talking about the spiritual part of the program is like talking about the wet part of the ocean. This is an entirely spiritual program, and I was missing that. You know, I blew that part off. And as a result, you know, it also says, you know, there are 12, by the way, there's 12 steps in this program, you know, and I never worked with others. You know, I didn't do anything. But this time back, I was willing to do anything, and that's what I did. And I listened to people. I had some great people working with me. There was this guy, Jimmy Egan, and I could relate to him because he was, in his day, he was crazy too. He'd spent lots of years in Attica prison, and he came out, and this guy was like a spiritual giant, you know. He was peaceful, you know. And I saw people whose lives, you know, the promises were actually coming true. And that was not the way I felt. It's, you know, life was tough going for me. I did not enjoy it until I started doing what it suggested. And, you know, when I started doing it, it's just, it's so different. The, you know, my first years back, mainly the first year, it was tough. You know, I was still, you know, toying with the idea when things came up of suicide and stuff like that. That was, you know, but I wasn't toying with the idea of a drink anymore or a drug. I just kind of wrote that off for a while. And what I had to resort to as a result of this was praying. And that's something I hadn't really done the early passes. I mean, I had nothing left. I mean, there was no, a drink isn't going to make it better. A drug isn't going to make it better. What am I going to do? Pray. Oh, Lord. Didn't want to do that, but I did it. Because they told me, you know, because I didn't understand the prayer. I didn't have a higher power when I came in, you know, except the alcohol and the drugs. But, you know, they said, all you need to know is that there is one and you are it. Start praying and start working the steps. And I did, you know, and that's where the progress started, was, you know, with the inventory. Because I asked people, I said, well, how do you turn your will over to God, you know, and they said, well, you pick up a pencil and start writing. You know, that's how you do it. Because it's all a bunch of practical steps. That's the purpose of these steps, is to, you know, let us find a higher power of our understanding. And, you know, I started doing that because it became essential. I mean, I would wake up every morning and I would start reading, you know, from page 84, you know, just steps 10 and 11. And I would read it in the morning. I would read it at night. I would be praying in the morning, praying at night. Get down on my knees a million times during the day to say the Serenity Prayer, about wore that out, you know. And I just, you know, just kept doing this stuff. And eventually, things started getting better. You know, my life started getting better. I started, we read these promises all the time, you know. Intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Before I got here, I intuitively knew how to do that. You take a drink or a drug. I mean, that's how you handle situations that baffle you. You know, it didn't work, but, you know, that's what I did. But I didn't know how to handle it in real life. Also, that, you know, comprehend the words serenity and know peace. The closest understanding I had of serenity and peace was a blackout. You know, wake up, don't know what happened, but I sure feel peaceful, you know. And it was nuts, you know, unless you ended up in jail, then you didn't feel real peaceful. But it's, you know, I think I mentioned that there are a couple things that I did different. One was finding a higher power. The other one was this working with others. Because when I was back, maybe a week, this guy says, oh, someone call, we got a 12-step call, come with me. And I did. And I started getting, you know, and they started explaining to me, even if you only have a couple weeks, you get a couple weeks more sober than the guy that just walked in the door. So you got something you can share with them. And, you know, for me, that's what I had to do, was start concentrating on other people. Because there's a part in the big book that I really, really hated, you know, where it says, you know, that the root cause of our problem is that we're selfish jerks, you know. I said, wait a minute, nah, not me. And, you know, the only cure for that is to try to do something that's unselfish. And, you know, I started, you know, trying to care about other people, which was totally alien for me. It's really funny, because when I was caring about myself so much all these years, I was not doing a good job of that. I mean, my life was not getting any better. It was getting worse, and I was making everybody around me, their life worse. And, this time, my life's getting better, and I think maybe some other people's are getting better. And, you know, it's just, there are all these steps, and, you know, to be able to share them with other people. I've had people around here that, you know, spent a lot of time talking to me when I was going up to them, moaning about how miserable my life was. My sponsor was good at that. He could ruin a pity party in about 10 seconds, you know. You know, as I wanted to get back, when I first came in, I wanted to get back with that wife, the one that had brought home the, you know, her fiancé. I said, because I wanted to, you know, we had two kids, and I wanted it all to live happily ever after. And that never happened. And he told me, he says, you know, what you want and, you know, what's going to be good for you in the long term, you know, those may be two different things. And, you know, you just, you accept it. And I'd whine. I'd say, oh, yeah, but I don't. And he'd say, so is she making you feel this bad? And I knew better than that. So I'd say, well, no. And he'd say, so you're sentencing yourself to feel that way. I said, yeah. He said, well, how long are you going to sentence yourself? You know, I said, damn. You know, I mean, like I say, he'd ruin a good pity party. He just really would, you know, because he'd put it in terms I understood. And just kind of going on from there, you know, just trying to work with others, come to lots and lots of meetings. And, you know, I've had ups and downs in the program. You know, life keeps happening. If you're sober long enough, life's going to keep happening. Today, alcohol and drugs had no value whatsoever in my life. And I could not always say that. I mean, even after a few years, I couldn't say that. First of all, you know, the compulsion had left, and that was beautiful. After a few weeks, the compulsion was gone. You know, so I didn't have this total obsession. But, you know, it would pop up in my head, you know, periodically. Oh, a drink might be a good idea or something. You know, and that was still hung there. And even when that disappeared, you know, after a while, you know, in the back of my mind, I always had this thing, well, you know, everything's moving smoothly, but, you know, if so-and-so dies, you know, maybe I'll, you know, so I still had this reservation back there. And I don't have that anymore. Because I know no matter what happens in life, a drink or a drug is not going to make it better. That's an absolute fact of my existence. I also have faith in a higher power today. And I know that no matter what happens, everything's going to be okay. And, you know, I had faith when I got here. I had faith that no matter what happens, things are going to suck tomorrow. They're going to get really bad, you know? And, you know, this is a way better way to live. You know, that marriage, that second marriage did not work out. It's, you know, it just, it didn't. And the lady, you know, I was talking about, I think she's sober now for a couple weeks, you know, but my son, she was staying with my son for a while, and he was a junkie like I was. And, you know, she had OD'd and he had a Narcan her back to life twice, you know, a few months ago. And then she ended up going to jail for a while for violating probation, you know, for using the heroin again. So it's, you know, it's, I mean, you know, when you're 60 years old, jail's not probably a fun place to be, you know. So, you know. And I've been sober for a long time, and she's been out there all these years. That she's still alive is a miracle. But that's back to that thing. There but for the grace of God go I, you know, that I was able to grab onto this program this time. And I get, you know, I was told that your bottom is when you quit digging. You know, that's when it is. Because I'd had the jail things and, you know, the almost dying a number of times, you know, you know, broken bones. You know, I still, you know, when the weather changes, I remember all some of the fun stuff I did, you know. Like, I mean, the insanity. I fell off of a motorcycle and broke my shoulder, which, you know, on bad days, it still hurts. As a matter of fact, sometimes on good days, it still hurts. But at the time, I told someone, well, it's a good thing I was, you know, eating all those Quaaludes, or this would have hurt a lot more, you know. Had something to do with falling off of the motorcycle. But, you know, it's that's the way my thinking worked back then, and it was insane. And today it's, you know, wow, it's just, I have an opportunity to work with other people, and I go to about 7 meetings a week. And, you know, I go to a jail meeting. And I don't know if I do anybody in there a bit of good, but it sure helps me because I remember what it's like. You know, it's just because it was. I told you I was doing that year in jail up in Cleveland. I was in there 3 months, and I hadn't prayed forever and ever. I mean, this is back when I was in my late 20s, and I look over to the. This was an old jail, like about a 100-year-old jail. It was out of a Humphrey Bogart movie, a prison kind of thing with a tower in the middle. And I'm laying in bed, and I'm saying, okay, God, you know, give me some sign here. You know, I don't know, you know, what's a nice young man like me doing in a place like this? And I see this light across the yard, and what it was is someone started a fire in the chapel, and the place burnt to the ground, and there was a riot, and it was all kinds of interesting things. And I was saying, okay, if this is a sign, I have no idea what the hell that means. So I quit praying because it was really weird, you know. But, life is different today. I got a relationship with a higher power. And, you know, I get to talk to lots of people on a daily basis about this program and to try to stay active and maybe give back just a tiny bit. But there were some giants in this program that just, you know, they saved my life is what they did. They were willing to take the time to talk to me, and I was incoherent, you know. I may still be incoherent, I don't know, but it's, you know. They took the time, and they explained about what they had done. Now, I cannot tell anyone what to do and, you know, expect them to do that and expect it to work. But I can share with you, you know, what I've done. What I know for me, anyways, is my life was just total chaos forever, you know, and I would sometimes get in these controlled modes where, you know, the wreckage wasn't as bad. But I was owned by alcohol and drugs. You know, they just owned me. And what happened was it helped create a way of thinking. They were the solution to all of my problems. I had no other way to cope. So I guess from the time I was 14, you know, when other people are learning life skills, how to cope with things that are unpleasant and stuff, I was just enhancing that one coping skill I had, you know, and just doing more and more and figuring out new and creative ways to do it. And the results were not good. It's just so weird. I look back on the thing and say, because I kept trying to grasp happiness, and the effect was like trying to grab smoke. You know, I wanted all this peace and serenity and happiness. And I think that's what I was looking for. And I just reach out. And I never got it. You know, I never got it. But, you know, I came in here and started saying, well, let's start worrying about what other people are doing so you take the focus off of you for a while. Because what helped is I was in such bad shape that taking the focus off of me seemed like a good idea. You know, so I'd just start paying attention to other people. And when I did, amazingly enough, my life started improving, you know. All these things, you know, all the wreckage of the past, you know, I came in, I could not even open a checking account, you know. I don't know if they had a number for how low my credit rating would have been. I owed the IRS $20,000. It's just, and those were the high points. I mean, I don't know. When you get to the point where suicide is a great idea, that's not good. That's not good. And, no matter what happens, like I said, no matter what happens in my life, it's just going to continue to get better. This program has so much to offer. I got involved in some service work doing GSR stuff and DCM stuff and did that for years. And, I'll probably rotate back into that, too, or do different jail meetings or do this or that, But anything to take the focus off of me, because, I'm one sick dude when I start looking at me, So it's, I don't know, I am just so blessed. And they told me a thing a long time ago. It says, when you're done talking, you ought to sit down. So I want to thank you all for listening.